But now here he is, dragged up steps by a pair of stormtroopers, his heels kicking against the hard stairs, his hand trying to catch a hold of something, anything, a railing, a light fixture, a door handle. Ahead, another staircase. Temin darts his hand out, catches the lip of a small fountain pressed into the wall. He curls his fingers around the stone and pulls himself free. Both stormtroopers cry out in alarm and come after him. He stabs out a kick, catches one in the chest. The stormtrooper oofs, but captures his foot. Then the Imperial pistons a fist into Temin's stomach. The air goes out of him. An ache runs through him, down his legs, up his arms. Again, they pick him up, carrying him up the second set of steps and through a set of red doors, out onto the roof. Temin coughs, blinking back tears. He hears it now, the sound of chanting, yelling. The crowd. No, no, please! He pleads with them as they haul him toward the roof's edge. The two stormtroopers lift Temin over their heads. He can see the crowd now. Massive. They're streaming in from all directions. Signs, effigies, rocks, bricks, bottles thrown. Akivans, protesting the satrapy. Protesting the Empire. Temin missed it. He thought everyone just wanted to keep their heads down, like him. I'm on the wrong side of this thing. Mom, I'm so sorry.
Time to join your friends,
one of the stormtroopers says. He doesn't even know which one. All he knows is he screams as they pitch him over the edge of the roof. Temin falls! The yacht floats in the heat haze above the satrap's palace. Its front end hangs forward like a falcon's beak dipped in bronze. Black windows between bony pipes of red and gold. Two wings that angle down and lift upward at the end, appearing like the hands of a plaintive, supplicant monk. The yacht drifts so that it faces its side toward the palace, getting close to the corner of the rooftop as its gangplank extends out horizontally, dropping only at the last minute toward the roof to form a ramp. From the street, a few rocks fruitlessly pelt the underside of the ship. Stormtroopers move to the edge and fire their blasters down indiscriminately into the crowd. Nora thinks, you only dig the Empire's grave with actions like that. Because everyone sees. The Empire is a thug, a bully. It's no better than Serat Nuot, or Black Sun, or the Syndicate of Huts. The Empire pretends it's about law and order, but at the end of the day, it's about dressing up oppression in the costume of justice. The Admiral must understand it too. She catches up to the stormtroopers and pulls them back, rebuking them loudly. Ahead of Nora, the other esteemed guest of the Empire, their targets, the ones they hoped and failed to stop, board the ship. The fox-faced man, the one she believes is Moff Pandion, gives them a dismissive look, as if they're greasy swamp clay stuck to the underside of his boot. A mess that must be scraped off and flung away. Then he, too, ascends the ramp. Nora looks to Jazz and Singier, both of them standing there, hands bound behind their back, each hedged in by stormtroopers so that there's no way to run, and nowhere to go if they did. Then the door opens again, and Nora finally sees it's Captain Antilles. Her heart breaks. His injuries have him in their grip. His hair is spackled to his forehead with sweat. His pallor is the color of fireplace ash. He's strapped down to a hovering table, ushered forward by a pair of stormtroopers and a 2-1B medical droid. As he passes, his eyes flutter open, and he sees her. Pilot, he says. Captain, she responds. He gives her a weak smile as they push him onto the yacht. Nora looks to Singier.
What's going to happen to us?
Well, the ex-Imperial sighs. I will probably stand trial. Jazz will probably die. You, I cannot say. prison, execution. Perhaps you'll join your rebel friend and be part of a peace settlement.
I'm sorry about all of this.
Not your fault, Jazz says.
He was her son, Sinjir notes, staring at them with his one good eye. The other remains swollen shut. Her blood in his veins. I can reserve a little bit of judgment for her. I think I've earned that luxury. Jazz starts to protest, but Nora interrupts.
He's right. You can lay the blame at my feet. I just hope, despite it all, my son is okay.
Sinjir smirks. Nora, I don't think any of us is okay.
Nora Temin is a survivor, Jazz says. He has what it takes. If anybody will make it out of this alive, it will be him.
Temin is dead. He's sure of it. He could not have survived. And now this feeling, this strange and impossible feeling, he's floating, drifting across what feels like the calm waters of Farsego Bay in the south. He and his mother and father used to go there sometimes on vacation. There they'd fish or sail spray boats, or try to scare up some of those gleaming carlapi shells, the ones that caught the sun just right and gave off a rainbow of light. He doesn't hear the water or smell its brine. And Temin doesn't much believe in an afterlife anyway. The boy opens his eyes. He is floating, buoyed, carried on the hands of the crowd. They caught him.
By all the stars and all the satellites, they caught me!
He laughs, a mad cackle that sounds not unlike that of his crazy droid. Then he remembers his mother, and Jazz, and Sinjir. He doesn't have much time. He lifts his head and rolls off the carpet of hands that's been carrying him, and he drops down into the crowd itself. For a moment, he's lost. It's hard to get his bearings in this sea of people. The throng overwhelms. But then he spins and sees the massive palace walls rising up.
I have to get back up there.
He starts to push his way through the crowd. Rocks pelt the walls and rebound. He sees people trying to climb up. A Rodian scales the wall and dangles from a balcony. A pair of humans try to help each other up. And Temin thinks,
that's my way.
He hasn't played with his friends in a while. Hasn't been the street rat urchin for a few years now. But he still knows how to shimmy up a drain pipe, or clamber up a wire mesh grate, or find handholds where none seem to exist. He doesn't have time to figure out the best way up. Instead, all he can do is climb with the others. As they load the final passengers, the prisoners taken from the catacombs beneath the palace, the satrap catches up and drops to his knees.
Please, 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 you must take me with you. I am besieged. They are climbing the walls like monkey lizards. They will tear me asunder.
Sloane puts her hand on his shoulder.
You've done the Empire great service, Satrap Istra.
The smile on his face spreads like butter. He believes he is being saved. His chest rises and sinks with relief.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Admiral. You are too kind.
But we no longer require your aid.
What?
Bewilderment crosses his face. He doesn't know if he's being punished, rewarded, put out to pasture, or what.
I don't...
She gives a nod. Two stormtroopers grab Istra and drag him back toward the doorway. He kicks and yells like a petulant child.
You cannot do this!
He cries, froth forming at the corners of his mouth like so much flotsam.
I have been good to you! Guards! Guards!
Two of his palace guardsmen come rushing through the door. They are cut down by the stormtroopers' blaster rifles, dead before they even had the chance to protect their erstwhile leader. The satrap bleats like a throat-cut stock animal. The troopers toss him to the ground, and he crawls between the corpses of his guards, weeping. Sloane steps aboard the yacht. The crowd roars. Temin's fingers barely hold on. Crammed into a tight crack running up the palace wall. His muscles ache. He hasn't done this for a while. He lifts himself up. Just as the crowd surges, they pull back from the walls. Someone lobs something against the palace doors.
What was that?
The building rocks. A thermal detonator blast buckles the doors. The fingers on Temin's left hand slip out of their mooring. He dangles, one arm straining, his feet scrambling to find any kind of ledge to bolster himself. The crowd surges again. They swarm against the injured door, pushing in. Some four-armed basilisk comes bounding through the mob with a massive forge hammer and charges the door.
No time to worry about that.
Temin screams through clamped teeth as he reaches up and regains his handhold. The boy continues his ascent.
Morna sits in the captain's chair of the yacht. Ray enters, sits next to her.
Cushy,
she tells the pilot. Morna nods.
No kidding, Admiral. Everything gleams. And these chairs, I feel like I'm still sinking into them.
Don't get used to them. Comfort is not an imperial priority.
At that, Ray offers a faint smile. Any problems with Crassus's pilot?
He fought me, but I made him recognize the Empire's authority, and I assured him he would still be paid for his time.
He's locked up, isn't he?
In one of the bedrooms, yes.
Adia, too, is in one of the bedrooms. Ray exhorted her assistant to go lie down for Star's sake. The woman has been impeccable in her aid, and brave in her defense of the Empire. Ray told her to rest up. She put her in one of the cabins next to Captain Antilles and his guard.
Excellent. Are we ready to depart this execrable planet?
We are, Admiral. And I just got the report that the Star Destroyers have returned to orbit from hyperspace. We have coverage from the Vigilance, the Vanquish, and the Ascent.
Then let's bid farewell to this sweat-slick steam bath.
Morna nods. She powers the engines up.
The yacht begins to move.
The yacht begins to move. Temin scrambles over the edge of the palace roof and sees the gangplank pulling back and the yacht easing away from the edge.
I'm too late.
He looks around, eyes darting quickly.
There! The satrap.
Blubbering between the bodies of two of his own guard retinue. Their vibropikes lie off to the side.
This is stupid,
Temin thinks, hurrying over and kicking one of the pikes up into his hands.
This is the worst idea,
he thinks, and he turns and runs full tilt toward the edge of the roof.
I am a laser-brained mooncalf who is going to die,
he decides as he plants the tip of the pike down hard and uses it to launch himself off the palace roof.
I'm dead! I can't make this! I've made a huge mistake!
The pike is out of his hands. Temin's arms pinwheel through open air as the yacht drifts. The side of the ship comes up fast. He slams into it. His hands reach for a hold, but they don't find one. He hears the pathetic squeak as he paws at the metal and starts to fall. But then, he stops falling. His hand catches one of the decorated pipes outlining one of the windows. Temin clutches it tight and brings his other hand up and pulls himself up. There's a moment of triumph, a flutter in his chest as he thinks,
I made it! I totally made it!
And then the yacht starts to lift up, and he realizes,
why did I do this? I'm gonna die!
The ground beneath starts to shrink as the yacht ascends.
So close,
Ray thinks, easing back into the co-pilot's chair.
Almost there.
This entire trip has been a failure. She realizes that now. But failure cannot be the end of it. Failure has to be illuminating. An instruction manual written in scar tissue. What then are the lessons of this? What has been learned, and what can be built from the wreckage? One, consensus will not be easy.
and it may in fact be difficult enough that it's not worth pursuing. 2. The Empire is fractured. That is not new information, but it has been clarified here. And a new dimension is revealed to her as a result. Many inside the Empire do not want to heal those fractures, but rather want to use the division for their own designs. 3. If the Empire is to survive, then they must... A red blip on Morna's screen. The pilot frowns.
What is it?
Ray asks.
Could be a bird, the pilot says. Though if it is, it's a very big bird.
She shakes her head and clarifies.
Something's on the hull.
Ray nods.
I'll send some men to look into it.
Sinjir kneels next to the others. His face feels like pounded dough. There they wait in this opulent room toward the back of the yacht, kneeling like slaves in a plush room of couches and tables. The fat banker, Crassus, sits in the corner, smoking spice out of a long obsidian pipe. His slave women, in their beastly masks, buff and trim the nails of his plump, desiccated feet, cutting the calluses off his awful toes. On the one side of Crassus sits Jillia Shale, a general. Sinjir knows her, or rather, knows of her. Depending on who you talk to inside the Empire, she's either a legend or a traitor, a conqueror or a cur. She has a pair of red-cloaked Imperial guardsmen with her. On the other side of Crassus, the purple-robed advisor. Sinjir doesn't remember that one's name, though he's fairly sure Jazz told him. One of Palpatine's inner circle, most likely. An acolyte of the Sith side of the Force, though certainly not a proper practitioner of it. Essentially, a cultist. Across from Sinjir, Pandion sits, stock straight, staring at them. No, staring at him, at Sinjir.
I know I'm handsome, Sinjir says,
an unintentional growl in the back of his throat as he speaks, a rattle from injury, not rage. Pandion only chuckles. It looks like he's about to say something, but then a small contingent of stormtroopers hurries past, toward the middle of the ship. They look alarmed. Pandion tries not to flinch, but it happens. Sinjir says with a smirk,
"Something's wrong, isn't it?"
"Steal your lips, traitor, or I'll cut them off."
"Gonna die, gonna die, gonna die!" Timon holds on with every ounce of willpower he can. Already wisps of clouds are passing by. The air grows cold. The ship starts to shudder with turbulence. He starts to think, maybe I can crawl down underneath the ship, use my multi-tool to pop a maintenance hatch, climb into the belly of the ship, and... The window above him pops open with a hiss. A stormtrooper's head pokes out.
"Hey!"
That's as good an invitation as Temen's going to get. He reaches up, hooks his hand behind the stormtrooper's helmet, and yanks the Imperial soldier out through the open space. The trooper's scream is loud at first, and then fades as he falls. Temen crawls up inside the open window. He belly flops to the floor, panting. He shakes the blood flow back into his arms. He's in a hallway full of doors. Cabins for the yacht. He stands up, dusts himself off. Then someone taps him on the shoulder.
Uh-oh. He turns. There stand two more stormtroopers, rifles up. And behind them come a pair of red-helmeted Imperial guards, their cloaks sweeping the floor behind them.
"Hey, guys,"
Temen says, giving a fake laugh.
"Is this not the 1230 space bus to the Ordwalian Cluster Casino? No? Oh, awkward."
He turns and runs.
"Fragging fragget!"
John Burrell snarls, his face red. Nothing he's done has made this thing work, and now his target is fleeing toward orbit. He stands for a few moments, chest rising and falling.
Calm down, he tells himself. Think!
But he doesn't think, and he doesn't calm down. He roars in rage and brings his good fist down on the console again and again. Because whatever chance he had has been squandered, and the effort undertaken to capture this turret in the first place didn't do a damn thing to help the New Republic. And with the last hit, the console suddenly glows bright.
What the?
Outside the window, the twin cannons adjust, tracking the target. The whole turret shakes as it fires, filling the cockpit with the bright, demonic light of turbo laser blasts. It's going well. Too well. Sloane feels the twist of dread in her gut. And that twist only tightens when Morna turns and says with a frown, "We have a problem, Admiral."
"Of course we do."
"What is it, pilot?" "A rebel fleet coming into space above Akiva."
Perfectly atrocious timing.
"How big?"
"Big enough to be a problem."
"Let's just get us to the Vigilance safe, Morna. Then we can..."
Again, the pilot screen starts flashing.
"What now?" Ray snaps.
Morna's eyes light up with panic and confusion.
"One of our turrets, from the ground. It's tracking us. It's about to..."
The ship rocks and shudders. Ray's head snaps back, and she tumbles out of her chair. Everything goes dark. Lasers scorch the air above Temin's head. He runs, ducks, and dives onto his belly to avoid getting cooked. He rolls over and puts his hands up to surrender. He can see they're not going to let him. The stormtroopers raise the rifles again, and the wall next to them suddenly disappears. The ship jolts hard to the right as a bright flash tears through it, ripping it open from underneath, taking the wall, the floor, and the Imperials away. What's left of them spirals away out the open hole. Wind keens like a mournful beast. Temin feels it start to pull at him as the whole hallway depressurizes. He grabs out with a hand as the yacht starts to dip, catching one of the cabin door handles. Fixtures start popping off the walls, vacuumed out into the swirling clouds. At both ends of the hall, pressure doors start to close, sealing off the middle portion of the yacht. Temin kicks open the cabin door, pulling away from the hungry winds trying to suck him out into the void. He throws himself inside. Emergency klaxons blare. The panel dash on the shuttle is lit up in an array of panicked flashes. Ray hauls herself back into the chair. Morna never left hers. Her arms are extended outward, and the tendons in her neck stand taut like bridge cables. She fights to keep the yacht aloft. It starts to dip, but she pulls back, and she again lifts its nose. "Status!" Sloane demands. "Kinda busy, Admiral!" Morna hisses through her teeth. Ray wants to chastise her, but the pilot is right. She instead pulls up the screen, sees the damage was straight to the middle underside of the yacht, near to where the first floor cabins are. Both halves of the ship are sealing off with pressure doors, which means they're not dead yet, and nobody has to abandon ship. But it does mean that the front half of the yacht, in which Ray sits right now, is separate and in fact inaccessible to the back half. And the middle of the ship is a no-being's land. The ship bounces and judders like it's about to come apart. Morna warns,
"The atmosphere is rough up here. Could tear us apart. Almost to orbit. Almost there. Keep it together,"
Ray demands. If anybody can do this, Morna can. The lights buzz and flicker. They go from darkness to red emergency lighting, back to full lights, then back to darkness once more. Jazz doesn't know what happened, but best guess is that they took a hit. From where, she cannot say. She's surprised they're still aloft. Good thing this is a pretty big ship, but even still, they're all lucky that the whole thing didn't get sheared in half with both pieces plunging to planet side. Panic has filled the Imperial ranks now, murmuring and frittering about. Crassus whining about his yacht.
The advisor, Yup Tushu, praying in some heretical tongue to beseech whatever dark force he calls upon in times of crisis. Shale simply leans forward, head between her legs, like she might be sick. She's a general, used to, in part, being on the ground, or in a cloistered war room somewhere. She's not a soldier, or at least hasn't been for years. Jazz, for her part, just sits still. Like Pandion, who seems to have a real hate for Sinjir, it's there in the way he stares at the other man. Black eyes like a pair of blaster barrels ready to fire. A stormtrooper enters.
We're cut off from the front of the ship. Pressure doors have sealed us off.
Pandion, without turning his gaze from Sinjir, picks up his communicator and speaks into it.
Admiral Sloan, are you there?
His calm crackles. Her voice emerges, broken, staticky, but there.
Moff Pandion, we're presently occupied.
Should we expect to die? This ship has escape pods, does it not?
Sloane's voice returns.
We're safe, almost in orbit. Patience!
Jazz doesn't know what's going on, but chaos has sunk its teeth into the situation. And in chaos, there lurks opportunity.
Interlude. Bespin. Cloud City.
They're coming in!
Morgan Kaw cries to his young girlfriend, the dancer, Lenara. She gives him a look of panic as he gestures toward the front door of his luxury domicile, where a line of sparks is drawing its way up the outer edge of the magna-locked portal. The sparks burn bright and ease upward with the speed and perfection of a confident, practiced hand. The older man fumbles around the foyer table and finds a ceramic vase from the Vinzer legacy. It's an artifact many millennia old, dating back to the Old Republic, or so he's told. All he cares, or cared about, is that it's worth something. The way it's shot through with blue lassite, like gleaming cerulean spider webs, blazing blue. He hates to do it, but he palms the vase.
It's a weapon, he thinks. Not an ancient, valuable artifact.
His heart hammers in his chest. Did he take his tincture this morning? Did he forget? Is he going to die?
No, I've lived this long. I'm on the list.
Cloud City has become quite the destination to procure rare implants. New oculars, custom-tailored hands, whole new organ systems for whatever human or alien can pay. He needs a new heart. He was on the list. Still is, he hopes. But then the rebel villains had to muck everything up, and the Empire stepped in and took over this sector. And now all those implants are on hold.
The Imperials will fix this. The Emperor has assured the galaxy of peace.
The embers dance around the final curve of the door, then down to the floor. The portal hisses and slides open. Through the smoke, he sees the shapes of the trespassers. Lenara cries out, and Borgen grunts, and he heaves the vase hard. It hits to the side of the door, missing. It doesn't even break. The thing just goes thud and lands on the floor. Apparently the Vinzers knew how to make a vase. Figures storm in, blasters up. Two of them he doesn't recognize. A Devoronian woman and a lanky, clanking pad. A personal assistant droid, on whose tarnished silver faceplate someone has painted a black skull. The other two he does recognize. The local miscreant, Kars Tal'Korla, a.k.a. the Scourge of Cloud City. Hard not to recognize him. He's on every poster and cautionary holovid here in the city. The Empire wants him bad. And now here he is, live inside Borgen's own apartment. Wearing his trademark armor, a mismatched patchwork set of Mandalorian, Corellian, and even bits of Imperial Trooper thrown in for good measure. Next to him, though, is the real surprise. Jintar Oar. Fellow Onderonian. Wealthy beyond measure. One of the residents here in the luxury levels of Cloud City alongside Borgen. A friend. Or was once.
You!
Borgen says, pointing a thick finger at the man.
Jintar, that handsome prig. Sharp-cut beard, eyes like gray clouds. Even the lines in his face look distinguished. But as Borgen thrusts his accusing finger up, the Deveronian steps in, grabs his finger, and bends it back. Pain arcs like a blaster bolt up to his elbow. He howls in a way that shames him. A piggy, high-pitched squeal, like the sound one of those Ugnaughts makes when it tumbles into the machines. And then he drops to his knees, as she, with her other hand, jams the barrel of her blaster rifle against his forehead.
"Wait," Jintar says.
He reaches for her wrist, and she hisses at him like a snake. He stays his hand, but then says to her,
"Let me talk to him."
Kars gives a nod.
"Let them speak, but we're on a timetable here, so make it snappy."
To the assistant droid, he barks,
"Go find that access panel."
Access panel? Borgen's gaze follows the droid as it totters out of the foyer and down the hall. But before he can see where the metal man is going, the Deveronian grabs his chin with a rough pull and turns his face toward her.
"Your friend would like to speak with you."
Jintar kneels.
"Bor," he says, "listen to me. We've been lied to. Adelhard has sealed off the whole sector. Massive blockades with a ragtag Imperial remnant. But that's not how they keep control. They keep control by lying to us."
He takes a deep breath.
"The Emperor is dead, Bor. It's been confirmed."
"Lies!" Borgen hisses. "Of course, that's what his type would have you believe."
He gestures with his chin toward the rebel Kars. The scruffy pirate in the patchwork armor does nothing but scowl and shake his head.
"I've seen the holovids. You have too. Palpatine is alive and well on Coruscant, and..."
"He's just a stand-in, a proxy, an actor."
"No, more rebel lies."
"We've done the comparison. The vids don't match. This person in the dark robes isn't Palpatine. Different chin, different gestures. A poor facsimile."
"You're a traitor."
Jintar's face falls. Sadness flashes in his eyes.
"No, Borgen. You're the traitor."
"The Empire's been good to us."
"It has, but it hasn't been good to everyone else. And the righteous folks of the galaxy will see that. Which means I'm calling on you to act."
Jintar's voice softens. That man could coax a Slakari hound off a rotten carcass.
"We could use your help."
"Help? They want his help?" That's not happening. Borgen roars. He's been in a few fights back in the day. Back when he was a young mining baron on the Savar Coast moon. Sure, he's older now, much older, and heavier. But he lurches upward, slamming his head into Jintar's. Stars explode behind his eyes. He falls back on his tailbone. Someone reaches for him, but he cries out and swats the hand away. Jintar is wincing. His forehead is already showing the bloom of a future bruise. Borgen, though, tastes blood. It's the rebel's turn. Kars steps into view. Blurry. Borgen blinks. The pirate scratches at his stubble and twirls the pistol at his hip.
"Let's talk this through. You've got an access panel in the back. It's tied into the same conduit as Governor Adelhard's chamber up on the Prime Tower. We need that panel opened. You give us the code, we'll be happy. You don't give us the code, we'll have to do it ourselves."
Carr's mouth sharpens into a wicked razor-angle grin.
"And we won't be happy."
"Brutes! Bullies! Criminals!"
Kars sighs.
"Okay, then. Rorna?"
He gives a nod, and the Deveronian woman pistons a fist into Borgen's side. Borgen bleats and flails. Jintar catches his hands and wrenches them behind his back. He feels his hands being stuffed into something. A fabric bag. A sock, maybe? Then the rip of bonding tape coming off its roll as it winds around his wrists.
"Lenara!"
he cries.
"Lenara, save me!"
but his girlfriend merely looks down at him, the way a disappointed mother looks down at her troublemaker child. She asks Kars,
"Is there anything I can do?"
The pirate chuckles, then tosses her a roll of bonding tape.
"Why not close up that gassy vent of his he calls a mouth?"
Borgen protests.
"Lenara, I've been good to you. We love each other. Don't you do this to me. I'll punish you. I'll punish your whole family. I'll end their loans and stack debtors against them, and..."
She slaps the tape against his mouth, and she doesn't stop there. She winds it around his head once, twice, a third time. It looks like she's enjoying it. Translation, the Emperor will have your heads for this. Kars nods. From the back of the domicile, the sound of a whirring drill. Kars lifts a wristcom to his mouth.
"Tell Lobot we have to do it the hard way."
The Deveronian says in a lower voice,
"We could torture the code out of the rich man. It would be no small pleasure,"
said with a feral smirk. The pirate waves her off. Then away from his calm, he says,
"No, we have specific instructions. No such shenanigans. We're to keep this clean, above board. Blah, blah, blah. The Alliance doesn't do it like that."
Then back to his wrist.
Yeah, I'm listening. Tell Lobot to make sure he's standing by with the intrusion team. And get a message to Calrissian. Tell him we're almost in, and that he can transfer the credits."
He pauses.
"No, you know what? Tell him we're doing this one gratis. On the house. He and his New Republic pals can owe me a favor. Make sure to emphasize that. A big favor."
Scum. Scum. Jintar once more kneels down.
"You're on the wrong side of history, Bor. You never did understand that the galaxy was more than one man."
Chapter 35. And like that, the pale blue skies of atmosphere give way to the gradient darkness of space. And that gradient fades too, becoming not part shadow, but all dark. A comforting void. Because that's what it is to Rey. A comforting emptiness. It gives her pause. The vastness, the endlessness of it all. To feel small in it, but also powerful enough to matter in its midst. At present, though, she can find no comfort. Because ahead of them, war rages in the black. A brute force battle. No elegance, no aplomb. On one side, a trio of Star Destroyers firing salvo after salvo of blasts. Those attacks met by the incoming Rebel fleet. 5 ships, each smaller than the destroyers, but no less potent. And between the two of them, a swarm of ships like flocks of nightbirds, trading fire. Some of them burning bright as they spiral like the crackling, wheeling fireworks set off by laughing children. She chews her lip.
"How are we doing?"
she asks Morna. The pilot answers,
"Limping along."
"Sprinting or limping, just get us home."
Commander Augate is shaking. It's normal, at least for her. The battle here has begun, and in the beginning of any battle, she shakes. It's a combination of jangled war nerves and the rush of adrenaline hitting her like lightning overloading a ship's systems. For years, she tried to hide it. She took meds to still her hands, tried to remain hidden and alone during the first moments of a battle, because she couldn't have those with her see. The shaking was a sign of weakness. But eventually, she came to realize showing it off and not caring who cared was a sign of strength. So now she trembles, and she lets it happen. It's a natural part of who she is, as a warrior and a leader of soldiers. She calms herself by staring out at the black, and then back again at the battle map holographically projected above the table. All the pieces moving along as they must. A chaotic dance, but one given over to a kind of precious special order. now, though. A new blip. She taps the air, zooms in on this uninvited guest. A yacht? Uninvited and unexpected. Imperial? Or some unlucky Akivan land baron who thought to make a hasty escape during an unfolding space battle? It's either an idiot or a genius piloting that thing. Augate asks Ensign Targada, a gruff Klaatuinian with a high brow and a frowning mouth, an ex-slave who is loudly loyal to the New Republic, to track that ship's course.
It's headed for that Star Destroyer,
he says. An Imperial, then. Shoot it down? She hesitates. Things move more slowly than one would think. Big capital ships firing fusillade after fusillade at one another, while the fighters swoop and spin among the stars. And careful thinking can be a strength of its own. But hesitation can fast become a liability. Targada echoes her question.
Concentrate fire on the yacht?
No, she says sharply. It's damaged. It may play host to a target of high-value intelligence. Destroying it means destroying information we may need.
She curses under her breath. In an ideal world, they'd swoop in and capture. But the battle won't allow for such a precision maneuver.
Let's remove their options for landing. Concentrate fire on that Star Destroyer. If they don't have a place to land, they become quicker pickings.
The strange man throttles Temin. He's ruddy-cheeked, with a warty nose and pock-cratered cheeks. The man wears a pilot's leathers.
What's happening?
He asks. The lights flick on and off.
What's happened to my ship, you little urchin?
Temin shoves him back.
Get off!
The man snarls.
You better tell me what happened. Did you do something? Are you an insurgent? A rebel terrorist? Scum! Scum!
Then he rushes Temin. Temin cries out and throws a punch. The man's nose pops like a blister, and he goes down, whimpering.
Oh, my ship! My ship!
The boy has no time for this. He looks around, his eyes having a hard time adjusting when the lights keep strobing like that. The pilot starts crawling for the door, and Temin moves and kneels down in front of him.
Out that cabin door, it's death. You hear me? Death. You don't know that. I need to get to the cockpit. I can fly this ship. Me, only me. I'm a good pilot. Or was once. Then we need to get to the cabin. The pressure doors are sealed, you nerfwit. You know this ship? Tell me how to get somewhere, anywhere.
The man groans as he stands. His joints and bones creak and pop.
Move that bed back. There should be a maintenance hatch under there, but I don't have a tool to open it.
Is nobody ever prepared? Temin rolls his eyes and pops the multi-tool off his belt. He starts to move the bed. Sure enough, a flat hatch sealed with Flasner bolts. They'll take time. He gets to work. Pandion stands. Nora watches him take slow steps towards Sinjir, on whom he seems singularly focused.
You were an Imperial once, Pandion says. A loyalty officer. Isn't that right?
That is accurate, Sinjir says.
Ironic, then, that your own loyalty was in question.
Not really. I was taught early on in my training to see the weaknesses in others. It was only a matter of time before I saw the weakness in the whole of the Empire. Sinjir grins past bloody teeth. Look closely, and you see the whole thing is shot through with cracks and fractures.
Pandion walks closer, a slow, measured step, a cruelty flashing in his eyes, pulsing and flaring like the lights overhead.
The only weakness in the Empire is men like you. Men who are not committed enough. Men who betray the cause because of a failing inside them. Bruised hearts and diminished minds. The Empire is made stronger when fools like you fall.
Even with his hands behind his back, Sinjir manages a shrug.
"Seems to me," he says, "that the weakness in the Empire is in men like you, Moff Pandion. Paltry, ineffectual idiots. Men who want to be leaders more than they want to actually lead.
And besides, what is a Moff, anyway? A meager sector head. Even the name sounds weak.
Moff! Moff!
It's the sound a dog makes as it regurgitates its dinner."
Pandion backhands Sinjir. A line of blood snakes down the ex-Imperial's chin from his lip. Sinjir licks it away.
"Moff! Moff! Moff!"
he says again, mocking.
Nora warns him. "Sinjir, don't!"
But it's too late. Pandion is on him again, this time hauling Sinjir up by the collar of his stolen officer's uniform. He hits him once, twice, a third time, and Sinjir's head rocks back on his shoulders.
"Stop!" Nora cries. "Stop!"
Pandion hisses at her.
"Shut up, scum!"
Sinjir seizes the opportunity. He spits a tooth, one of his own, at Moff Pandion's face. It bounds off the space between the Imperial's eyes, and as he blinks in surprise, Sinjir headbutts him. Pandion staggers back. Twin streams of blood trickle down his nose. His face twists up like a terrible knot.
"Ugh! You traitor!"
He wipes blood from his nose, then draws his blaster.
"You won't make it to trial!"
Jazz speaks up.
"Let me do it."
Pandion squints.
"What?"
"I'll do it, for the right price."
"Price? After you've thrown in with this lot?"
"The bounty on your head was too good, Pandion. But I'm sure there's more than enough credits to compensate me. Looking at this yacht alone, I can see we're on a banking ship. Surely you're willing to pay me more than the New Republic was to capture you."
"Capture me?"
"It was all about you. You have a very high bounty."
He sneers, smirks.
"Yes, I should have expected that. How high was the bounty?"
10,000 credits.
"Should have been higher,"
he snits.
"Still, I'll give you 20,000 from Arson Crassus's coin purse to execute this traitor. Right here, right now. What say you?"
Crassus stands, blustery and blithering.
"What? You can't! I didn't make that offer! And yet I take it on good faith you wouldn't want to deny the Empire,"
Moff Pandion says. He turns the blaster toward Crassus.
"Right?" Absolutely. What's mine is yours."
Pandion chuckles.
"Good."
He spins the blaster around and approaches Jazzy Mori, extending the weapon out.
"Here you go, Zabrak. Take it. It's yours."
"Oh, what's that?"
"Your hands are bound."
He clucks his tongue.
"What a shame. Guess we don't have a deal. Because the Empire doesn't do deals with bounty hunters anymore."
He wheels back with the blaster and moves to strike her. Nora cries out. But Jazz is fast. Her hands, they're free. Somehow, she catches his hand and twists his wrist. Pandion cries out, and she snatches the blaster from him and wheels him around, pointing the gun to his head.
"Nobody shoot, or he take off the top of his head with his own blaster,"
Jazz warns. Jillia maintains her seat, and Crassus keeps standing. Stormtroopers and Imperial guards point weapons, but Pandion waves them off, saying,
"No, no! Wait! Put them down! Let her speak."
Nora thinks, how did she get free? But then Sinjir steps up. The shackles fall off his wrists, too. Suddenly, a voice calls from beneath her. She turns and looks, sees a pair of eyes looking up through the room-length vent that runs along the seam between the wall and the floor. A little multi-tool reaches out through the vent. She hears a voice.
"Mom, move your wrists closer. I can pick the lock."
Out the front of the yacht, a TIE fighter spirals toward them, fire jetting from its one side into the unforgiving maw of space. Morna yanks back on the flight stick, moves the flying brick out of the way just in time. Their own ship shudders as the TIE explodes somewhere out of sight. Ahead, a pair of TIEs chase a Rebel X-Wing. They swoop and dip. Beyond them, the Star Destroyer Vigilance.
Not far now,
Rey thinks. She brings up Tothwyn on the comm. His nervous face appears on screen.
We're coming in, Rey says. Bay G2D1.
Of course, Admiral. We're taking a lot of damage, and the shields...
Morna leans over.
We're coming in hot. I can't slow this thing down. Something is fritzed.
Rey adds,
have extinguisher droids on hand. We're coming in...
From one of the Rebel frigates, a massive blast arcs through space, striking the Vigilance. A burst of fire and debris from the bridge. Tothwyn's image dissolves, and the link is gone.
Admiral?
Morna asks.
We can't land there. The Vigilance...
remains for the moment. The plan is the same.
Admiral, I strongly advise...
I have a plan. Take us in. Same bay. The Vigilance remains... and I have a plan.
Tension in the room runs so high that should a pin drop, everyone might start firing their blasters. Jazz stands with Pandion's blaster held to his temple, her other hand clamped around his neck. Nora is up now, shaking off her shackles. Sinjir is helping Temen crawl up through a maintenance hatch in the middle of the floor. Nora rushes over and picks him up and gives him a long, crushing hug. Pandion jeers.
How touching. But what now, bounty hunter? You've got one weapon among you and a dozen pointed in your direction.
That one weapon is pointed at your head, she says.
Ah, yes. But then what exactly? We land and...
You continue this threat?
Eventually, you'll meet someone who doesn't care if I live or die.
I'd say we've already met several.
He scoffs.
This charade is temporary. What is your plan?
She wears a feral grin and licks her lips.
I have no plan. What I do have is your blaster and my friends and luck on our side. Plus, we're very good at improvising. As you can well see.
You'll pay for this.
No,
she says.
We'll get paid for this.
Rey straps in. The Star Destroyer looms closer and closer. Bay G2D1 awaits, covered with the faint blue shimmer of the shields. Shields that she believes are failing. Which means soon, the Vigilance will be no more. To Morna, she says,
I trust you not to kill us.
The pilot nods.
That's the plan.
She winces as she brings the yacht in through the front of the bay. Rey feels the speed now, sees everything zooming up to them fast. Too fast, and the deck rushes up. The yacht hits it hard. Pain goes through her, an ache through her wrists and neck as the G-forces threaten to rip her asunder. The yacht lands hard. And as the lights again go out, all she hears is the grinding of metal on metal as the whole thing shifts sideways, skidding fast and loose across the Imperial Star Destroyer's bay. Chapter 36. Sparks in the dark. Circuits pop and fizzle. Panels swing, hanging by loose wires. A haze of smoke fills the air. Smells duel for supremacy. The stink of hot metal. The odor of melting plastic. A third stench. Electric ozone. Light comes in from outside. Garish, bright, artificial light.
Nora groans and lifts her chest off the uneven ground. She tries to figure out what happened, but it doesn't take her long to realize, because she's been in this situation too many times before.
We crash-landed.
Underneath her, Temen lies unmoving.
Oh, no! Temen! Temen! She pulls him up, and he suddenly draws a sharp breath, his eyes fluttering open. She laughs and pulls him close.
Ow! He says.
Sorry.
No, I'm sorry.
Not now, she says. Later. Now we have to...
Someone moves through the space. Nora's eyes adjust, and she sees Jazz stalking through the ruined room, emerging from a whirl of black smoke. She stands over a body, points the blaster down, and fires. The blue pulse from a stun charge warbles in the air. Whoever is lying there shudders and goes slack. Jazz looks over, sees Nora. She reaches out a hand and helps her up, then Temin. To the boy, the bounty hunter says,
You're late. Jazz, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean... Stop there. We're fine.
From behind them, a cough and sputter before Sinjir says,
Yes, please. I'm not dead, but I may yet choke on your rank sentimentality. I cannot say for sure exactly what happened, but I'd put considerable credits down on a bet that says we should not dally.
You talk a lot for not dallying,
Jazz says.
And you certainly do love an unnecessary retort,
Nora interrupts.
Focus up, crew. What's our status?
We crashed,
says Jazz.
Obviously.
She gestures with her foot by way of a gentle kick.
That body belongs to Advisor Yupta Shu. Now stunned. I also secured Jilia Shale, the general.
She points, and Nora can make out a crumpled shape.
Beyond her is Crassus. He didn't make it, along with most of these stormtroopers.
One starts to stir, and she fires a stun blast at him. He thumps back down to the ground with a gurgled groan.
And Pandion?
Gone.
Nora nods.
Come on.
They step toward the back of the room, and together they push on a scrap of metal. That's where the light's coming in. And collectively they peel back part of the hull, enough for them to slip through. Out there, the bay entrance, a rectangle looking out into space. And onto a space battle. New Republic ships launch a fusillade from their cannons. The darkness is lit up with the vigor of war. In here, in Imperial Star Destroyer Bay, alarms go off. The entire ship rumbles and vibrates. A TIE interceptor screams past the bay entrance, chased by a pair of arrowhead-shaped A-wings. Nora thinks,
I want to be out there.
An odd feeling. A scared feeling, but eager and hungry for it just the same.
Look,
Temin says. She follows him, pointing. At the other end of the bay, a line of Lambda-class shuttles and a pair of TIE fighters. One of the shuttles lifts up off the ground.
You, Nora points to Jazz. Take the others. Get your bounties and haul them on board one of those shuttles. You can fly it, right?
Jazz nods.
Not as well as you, I wager. But yes, I'm capable.
Capable? Sinjir says. There's that word again.
You help her, Sinjir. Temin, I need you to do something real important. Are you listening?
Okay. Say the word.
Go back inside that yacht. Find Captain Wedge Antilles. You hear me? Find him and get him out.
Please let him be okay after all this.
Temin asks,
Mom, what are you doing?
I'm going to take one of those TIE fighters, and I'm going after whoever that is.
She points to the shuttle as it roars toward them, its cannons firing. She pulls the others down behind the wreckage of the yacht as the laser blasts stitch a line of craters along the docking bay floor before the shuttles race toward the exit and off into space. Nora wastes no time, because there is no time to waste. She's up on her feet, hard charging toward the TIE fighters.
She hears her son calling for her, asking her not to leave, asking her not to die, telling her to let it go. But she knows she can't. She knows who she is and what she does. And this is it. It's time to fly once more.
Chapter 37. Once again, the almost lunatic freedom of the TIE fighter.
Nora plunges the small Imperial ship into the maelstrom of battle.
Cannon fire is tearing past her in both directions, laser blasts crisscrossing the void in front of her.
She hunts the stars for her prey. And just as she sees the Lambda-class signal out there in the dark, an X-Wing comes diving from above her like a raptor bird. And she realizes, I'm in an Imperial ship. The Jedi are known for having the Force. She doesn't know what that is, or if it's even a real thing. Though Skywalker certainly makes it look like it's no myth. But she knows she doesn't have it. Just the same, she has what she has, which is an uncanny ability to just turn her brain off. Stop her mind from chattering. Stop thinking about details. Stop thinking and just feel. The X-Wing comes down on her, and she reacts without thinking, bringing the TIE fighter up where the X-Wing goes in the opposite direction. Then a Y-Wing is in her sights, and she has to juke the TIE back and forth, starboard to port and back again, in order to avoid the incoming blasts. She quickly fumbles with the communicator and signals to Rebel comms. This is Nora Wexley, call sign Gold 9. I have taken command of this TIE. Repeat, I have taken command of this TIE. Inside her head, she adds, please don't kill me. Commander Augate stands on the bridge of the old Alderaanian frigate, the Sunspire. Out there, she watches the battle unfold. It's easy to stare at it and be lost. Not lost because you don't know what's happening, but sucked into it. Drawn to it like a winged thing toward a plasma torch. Hypnotized, in a way. Idly, she realizes, we're winning this battle. Which means they're winning this war. There, though, a new question haunts Augate in the back of her mind. What then? Behind her, Ensign Ure stands. The blue-skinned Pantoran says,
we are winning this engagement, Commander.
Winning does not mean won. Keep up the pressure.
Yes, Commander. There's something else.
A pause, then.
There's a pilot out there in a TIE fighter, claiming to be, well, one of ours, from Gold Squadron. That seems unlikely. And yet it's what she claims.
She ponders. Could be a trap. But to what end? A single TIE fighter could do what? They are suicide machines. But why this ruse? Her gut twinges, tells her which way to go.
Give her support. Get her on the comm. Let's see what's going on.
Plugging in hyperspace coordinates is no easy feat during a space battle. Get it wrong and put the ship in the wrong space, and the only place you'll end up with great speed is the grave. Though here, Rey admits, if ever she is to die, it should be out here, in space. Born from stardust, returned to stardust. She cares little for such poetry, but this appeals to her somehow.
Almost there, Rey says. Keep us flying, Morna.
Her pilot nods. Inside her heart, Rey regrets the loss of those they left behind. Adia, in particular. Whether the woman is alive or dead, she cannot say. Adia certainly deserves life. But if death is her end, then it was a noble one in service to the great galactic empire. The door to the cockpit hisses open, which is curious because she and Morna Key are the only two on this shuttle. Or so she had thought. She wheels around, knowing already who she'll see. Pandion. He's got a blaster in his hand. A line of blood is drying upon a long cut crossing his brow. His nose appears broken, his mouth bloody, and the rest of his uniform looks dirty, dusty, in tatters. You survived, she says.
I did,
he says with a curious smile, a smile that quickly dies on his face.
Let me tell you how this will go. You're going to the Ravager. You will take me to that Star Destroyer. And then I will take control of it in return. It is mine now, Admiral, not yours. The last great weapon of the Empire is in my control, because you are incapable of wielding it.
The shuttle quickly ducks a hail of incoming blasts. Ray steadies herself on her chair. Pandion remains standing, leering, scowling.
You fool,
she says.
You eager, egotistical fool.
Grand Moff.
Ha! You have so much, so wrong. The Ravager is not the last weapon, nor do I even control it. There is another.
His face twitches.
You don't mean...
I do mean... He's not dead.
But you said he was.
I lied, she shrugs.
This was all his plan. Wasn't it? I should have seen it. I fell for a trap. We all fell for your trap, you betrayer! You foul, wretched betrayer!
Panic seizes her. She thinks,
no, it wasn't supposed to happen like this.
But then, the more terrible realization hits her.
But what if it was?
What if this was the plan all along? Suddenly, the ship shudders. Morna, without taking her eyes off the console, says,
we have company. It's a lone TIE fighter. It's firing at us. And rebel ships, too. Incoming.
Ray scowls.
New plan, then. You might want to buckle in, Valco. This is going to be a bumpy ride.
It feels good to be up here again. The TIE fighter makes Nora feel like she could thread a needle. And there, ahead, the shuttle. She takes a few shots, though the shuttle's deflector shields hold, but they won't for long, especially with the squadron of Y-wings coming in behind her for support. But then, just as she's got the shuttle in her sights, TIEs swarming like wasps. They're on to her. She no longer flags as Imperial to them, and they're taking their shots. She pulls away, leads three of them off. They're on her like magnets, following her every swoop and turn, her every roll and lurch. So she draws them back toward the Y-wings. The rebel fighters, dead ahead. Into the comm, she says,
stay on target!
It looks like a suicide mission. A game of chicken with her own people. Her own ships. But they know what she's doing. This is a practiced move. One the Imperials never expect. At the last minute, she pulls up, and the Y-wings open fire. The TIEs dispatched in gassy plumes of quickburn fire. Now back to that shuttle. It takes her a moment. The shuttle has deviated from its course. There, heading toward another of the Star Destroyers. The shuttle swerves toward the massive Imperial ship. Nora lines up her weapons, and she starts to fire. Pandion has chosen to remain standing, which is as expected. He won't sit. He won't risk looking weak. Ray thinks it will be his downfall.
That's your destroyer, the Vanquish. I'm going to take it.
He laughs.
I think you overestimate your...
Ray moves fast, grabbing the flight stick out of Morna's grip. She pushes it hard to the right, and the ship goes into a quick spin. Pandion loses his footing. Morna quickly rights the ship, and when the Moff reclaims his balance, Ray is up out of her seat. She pistons a fist into his middle, then wrestles the blaster out of his hand. She fires a shot into his belly, then kicks him out of the cockpit. The door seals behind, and her fingers dance on the keypad next to it to ensure the seal holds. He wails on the other side, pounding. The ship shudders with blasts from that TIE fighter.
Let's give them what they want, Ray says. Let's give them this ship. Let's give them Pandion. Let's give them a show.
Morna nods. She begins the detachment sequence while Ray punches the self-destruct codes into the hyperdrive matrix. It all happens so slow, and yet so fast. Nora fires the TIE cannons at the engines of the shuttle. She wears the shields down like a kid scratching the paint off one of his toys. And then she scores a direct hit. The engines flare bright blue, and she expects them to go dark. But they don't. They do the opposite. They erupt in crepuscular rays, and Nora has to shield her eyes. The shuttle suddenly lists left, drifting not like a ship, but rather like a piece of space debris. And she realizes late, too late, it's going to blow.
And blow it does.
The entire shuttle shudders and detonates. Fire blossoms into open space. Nora tries to move the tie out of the way, jerking on the controls to maneuver hard and fast to starboard. But fire fills her window, and everything shakes. Sparks hiss up out of the console and down on her head, and she thinks, this is it. It's over. At least I went doing what I wanted to do. At least I went down fighting. At least Temin knows I love him. I love you, Temin.
And then, she's gone.
Interlude. Jakku.
This is a dead place,
Corwin Ballast thinks. Out there, it's nothing. Nowhere stretched wide and made infinite. The dry crust of desert.
The whipping tails of dust.
Past that, dunes. Mounds of sand, red as fire. They seem to run on forever underneath the cloudless sky. Behind him, ragged, ratty tents, propped up by scraps of rusted pole and rebar, some of it kinked with an arthritic bent. The wind threatens to pick it all up and carry it away, but it never does. These tents have been here for so long, they're a part of the world, just like the people. Corwin steps out of his speeder, a limping junker he bought from a couple of anchorites outside of Tuanol. He gave them more than he owed. Charity. What does it matter now, anyway? Then he descends among the scavengers, the cast-offs, the dregs of the galaxy's populace. All of them dust-cheeked. Scarred, too. Branded by the roughness of this place. A round-faced brute with a crown of wispy black hair and a fat body, wreathed in rags, steps in front of him, licking his chapped lips and chuckling.
What have we here?
But Corwin knows the play. He's no fool. Not anymore. He hooks his thumb around the button loop of his jacket and tugs it back, showing off a lean, mean, vent-barreled high-core laser repeater. Seeing it, the ragman grunts and wanders off in search of prey that doesn't sting or bite. Corwin, for his part, searches out the bar. It's not much to look at. The bar has been welded together out of scrap. The whole thing warped and crooked and shaped into a rough half-circle. All of it underneath the cap top of a 323 Rockman concussion miner. Dust and sand hiss against the canopy of thin metal. Corwin pulls up a rusted stool next to a socket-eyed skull face, one of the Uthuthma, with swaddles of chain forming a scarf and obscuring its toothy maw. The alien chatters at him in its language.
Basil Washa Washota.
A statement or a question, Corwin doesn't know. All he does is wink and give the stranger a thumbs up. The Uthuthma keeps staring with those dead, empty holes it reportedly calls eyes. A loud, gurgling throat clear from behind the bar, and Corwin turns to see the tender. Big fella, muscle gone to fat, nose like a fallen tree. Whole right side of his face is peppered with scars, some of them lumpy with bits of scree and stone. One bit of gravel is bigger than the pad on Corwin's thumb and sticks in the man's cheek the way a rock pokes up out of dry, dead ground.
What are you having?
What do you got?
Nothing but one thing. Knockback nectar, they call it.
If you only have one thing, then why ask me what I'm having?
The bartender shrugs and snorts.
People like the illusion of choice. Gives them comfort in these strange times.
And I'll have that, my good man.
Good man? Huh?
The bartender mutters,
then pours from an old oil can into a smaller oil can and plonks it down in front of Corwin. The so-called nectar is the color of hydraulic fluid, and bits float in it. Spongy, bobbing bits.
What is this?
Knockback nectar! I told you already!
No, I mean, what is it?
You know, I don't ask. They just bring it to me. Something about scraping the lichen rocks from the dead buttes down in the south. I hear tell they pickle it in fuel barrels or some such.
It'll get me drunk?
It'll get a space slug drunk!
Corwin tips it back.
Ooh, it tastes like sour spit with a motor oil aftertaste.
Doesn't take long before his gums start to feel numb and his teeth buzz. Alrighty then. The Uthuthma babbles at him again.
Mathim Bachi, Istata.
May the force be with you too.
Corwin says. His voice is stripped raw after one sip of the knockback. The words wheeze out. He laughs. It's a mad, desolate, empty sound. Like this little enclave. Like this whole planet.
You're not from here,
the tender says.
What gave it away?
Not many folks from here. Most folks just end up here. Jettisoned like so much worthless cargo. Dropped like waste.
Corwin shrugs and chuckles and sips his poison.
You're a strange fella. You looking for work?
Could be. What's around?
Ha! Pfft. Not much. Most of the mining is on the far side, and even that's pretty meager. We do get magnite here, and bezerite, and there's talk of some new caesium gas wells going up near Crater Town, but that might just be rumor. You got the scavenger packs. You got the wheel races north of here. You could say your vows and be an anchorite, but nah, not you. And I'd say you could be a bartender, but turns out that job's taken.
I'll think about it. Thanks.
The tender keeps on him.
So how'd you end up here?
I didn't end up here.
Not from here. Didn't end up here. How'd you come to be sitting at Urgle's bar, then?
You Urgle?
I'm Urgle.
Well, Urgle, I came here.
You came here? Of your own free will and such?
Of my own free will and such.
Urgle stands there and stares for a good 10 seconds, then bursts out laughing. A big, booming, gurgling laugh, like he's choking on his own lung meats in the process. His jowls shake, and his belly bounces back and forth.
Galaxy's a big place, feller. Wide open as a Nexus fang-lined maw. The stars are endless. The worlds are countable, but not by one hand, and not by 100. You got planets and outposts, and stations, and spaceships, and...
More laughing.
You came here?
Corwin nods.
I did.
Why? I have to know. I have to know what drives a man to this.
Athen Fisfis, the Wawasin.
The Uthuthma says.
Shut up, Gaswin.
Urgle grumbles.
Let a man finish.
Then to Corwin.
Ignore the skull face. I gotta know.
Here, Corwin blinks a few times. And every time he does, he sees it happen again. Right there in his hometown. Right in Mayborn, on Mordal. His little girl lying there in the open street. The shallow rise and fall of her chest.
The Imperials entrenched at one end of town, the rebels on the other. Corwin's there off to the side, hiding behind crates of victuals with his wife, Linta. And suddenly she's up and running for the little girl, and then he's running after her, hard charging, screaming, reaching. Laser fire, crossing both directions. Linta's head snapping hard the one way, then she's down. Corwin leaps, but something burns into his side, cuts through him. He hears the sizzle of it, feels his system go through shock, like a bomb detonating underwater. Boom! Then he's out. When he wakes up, weeks later, on a back-to-drip, on a crawler outside of town, his family is gone, already buried. And neither side won its war. And both sides went home licking their wounds.
War,
Corwin says.
I'm tired of war.
You don't look like an Imperial. You are a rebel, I bet.
No, no rebel either. Just a man trying to make do with his family.
You brought your family here?
I did,
Corwin says. But he doesn't explain that he brought them only in his heart, and in the picture he's got stuffed in his boot.
Wanted to take them as far away from the fighting as I could. A place where the war will never find us. The farthest flung nowhere rock I could find on a star map.
Well, you found it, buddy. You don't get more nowhere than here. War ain't got no reason to roll up on this rock.
You promise?
If the war comes here, I'll buy you all the knockback nectars you want.
Deal.
This is a dead place, you know.
I know.
That works for Corwin. A dead place for him. A man gone dead.
Part 4. Chapter 38.
And then, she's back. Nora cries out in the darkness, and then light rushes in. Everything feels electric. Her body is bright, too bright. Everything vibrating and burning, and she's scrambling up and something's on her arm. She starts to yank at it, and something in her nose and mouth, and she pulls at that too, gagging. Coughing. Suddenly, someone is there, holding her, pinning her arms. Let me go, she wants to say. She tries to say it, but her voice is a scratchy, gargling mess. All she hears is a voice.
Shh, Mom. Shh, it's okay. It's okay.
Temin. Oh, by all the gods of all the stars, it's her son. He holds her close. She holds him back. She sees now. She's in a white room. Blue skies outside. A medical droid standing off to the side, ready to act. Temin kisses her cheek. She kisses his brow with chapped lips. Nora cries.
Days later, when she has her voice back, she sits in the lounge of the medical building here in Hana City. Out of the glass, she can see the city there, and beyond it, the wind-swept meadows. Chandrila has been a peaceful place, long separate from the war. It seems an artifact out of time, a souvenir from some other era. She sits there with two others, Admiral Akbar and Captain Wedge Antilles. Wedge looks better than she does, though maybe not by much. He's walking with a cane right now, though he says that should change soon. Akbar, for his part, looks tired, but he looks happy to see her, too.
You're quite something, Nora,
Akbar says.
I don't know about that, sir,
she says. Her voice is still scratchy.
She still feels edgy, touchy.
Ever since the droid woke her up out of that coma with whatever that chemical concoction was, She feels like an overcharged battery. Like she wants to get up and run, leap, dance. But her body can't do those things. She feels raw, sore, as tired as an old muskhound. Akbar and Wedge share a look. Wedge nods. Akbar produces a small box.
This is for you.
She gives a quizzical look and takes it. Nora hesitates, but Wedge urges her on.
Open it, Nora.
Inside, a medal.
I already have mine, she says. This must be a mistake.
One can earn more than a single medal,
Akbar says, somewhat gruffly. But his lips twist into a strange smile.
Your efforts on Akiva have had tremendous effect.
I hardly see how.
Humility is well and good, but facts persevere beyond the shadow of one's own feelings,
Akbar says.
You saved Captain Antilles. You helped us capture two high-value Imperial targets, General Tilia Shale and Palpatine's advisor, Yup Tashu, and confirmed the deaths of two others, Moff Falco Pandion and Slaver Arson Crassus.
The way Akbar says that word, slaver, it drips with rage and condescension.
Admiral Sloane?
Nora says.
What of her?
Wedge sighs.
We got her attaché, Adia Wright, but the Admiral herself got away. It's why you've been here for the last month, in a coma. She blew the shuttle and got away in an escape pod.
Nora realizes. Of course. The front cockpit of those Lambda-class shuttles becomes the escape craft. She finishes the story for him.
Let me guess. She took that escape craft right to the Star Destroyer. And they took that ship to light speed. Yes.
She scowls. Disappointment stabs her in the gut. Wedge reaches out and clasps her hands.
We'll find her. We still took down two Star Destroyers. It was a victory for the New Republic.
She nods and forces a smile.
Thank you, Captain.
There's something else,
Akbar says.
Sir?
I have more work for you, if you want it.
I don't know, sir. My son, I...
Just hear me out, will you?
She nods. She listens. And in the end, she says yes. Akiva. Still hot, still muggy. A storm came through the night before, and now the landing pad is littered with palm fronds and the fat, broad leaves and crinkly blue blossoms of the Asuka trees. The flowers lie matted against the ground, still pretty in their way, but drowned-looking, too. Nora stands there, a sack over her shoulder. Temin stands with her. He has a bag with him, too. A New Republic flag flies over this landing pad, and a Corellian Corvette roars overhead. Akiva, the first Outer Rim planet to officially have joined the contingent of worlds pledging themselves to the New Republic. The satraps saw the Empire's betrayal and the rage of the people of Mira, and decided that the only way to save their skins and their rule was to give it over, in part, to the Republic. And Nora thanks the stars that the First Order of Business was routing out corruption and crime. Surratt fled, but the rest of his gang went down. Many in prison. The rest went out in what they probably thought was a blaze of glory, but what instead will likely end up as a bloody and brutal footnote in Akiva's history books.
Are you sure about this?
She asks.
Yeah, I'm sure. You can stay here. I understand. I don't want to stay here. I thought this place was home. It's not.
She smiles.
It still could be. You're my home. Wherever you go, that's where I live.
She pulls him close. He says,
Do you think we'll find Dad still?
It's possible. Those data cubes you stole from Surratt had a lot of information about the Empire's criminal dealings. Jazz was the one who translated them. Looks like Surratt may have been collecting that information in case he ever had to bargain his way to freedom with the burgeoning New Republic. Temin stealing that from him bought him the only chip he had to play. The Archive offered a bounty of information connecting the Empire with several crime syndicates across the galaxy.
The Huts and other syndicates operate black site prisons for the Empire. I'm hoping our journeys will take us there.
The holocrons will, in part, inform their new mission.
But I also don't want to promise anything. Not like I did before. I don't know what's going to happen out there. You have to know that, Timon. But we'll try. Okay? We'll try.
I know.
He looks up.
Hey, here's our ride.
A ship drifts down, its twin engines pivoting and firing against the ground to slow its ascent. It's an SS-54 assault ship. On the side is the scratched-up painting of a little Tuca doll holding a sharp knife. The words that were above it are mostly gone, except for two.
Play nice.
It settles down, and once it does, three people step off. Jazz is the first off the ship, craning her neck and cracking her knuckles. Sinjir follows after. He's still got that rough-hewn edge. His scruff has grown out a bit more, though that imperial vibe still hangs about him like a miasma. Last off, a man with thick mutton chops that connect to a bushy mustache. Arm in a cast, blaster at his side, helmet palmed in his hand. He steps off and heads right for Nora, hand out.
Nora Wexley, I'm guessing,
he asks.
John Burrell,
she says, shaking his hand.
A pleasure to meet you, finally. I just want to say again, I appreciate you fighting the fight on Mira. I had thought all of you Spec Force guys and girls died that day. I'm happy I was wrong, and thanks for taking the initiative.
Temin walks past and mutters,
Though you almost killed us.
Your boy?
He asks.
My boy,
she says. Temin gives Jazz a hug, then gives Sinjir a punch to the arm. Nora calls after.
Temin, I think you're forgetting something.
Oh, yeah!
He sticks both fingers in his mouth and whistles.
Yo, Bones! Let's roll!
From far off the field, Mr. Bones jerks his head up. The droid, which Temin and Nora rebuilt together from scrap in Esmel and Shireen's basement over the last week, a family project, she said, waves. In one hand, a flower. In the other, a blaster.
Roger, roger!
The battle droid jogs past, leaving small craters in the landing field, which tells Nora they still have a little work to do on his pneumatics. Jazz and Sinjir come up to her. Jazz says,
So, are you ready to hunt some Imperial war criminals?
Oh, I guess, Sinjir says, pouting. I like to pretend we're going to be hunting down dangerous prey, but most likely we're going to be chasing a bunch of pudgy Imperial accountants across backwater worlds.
Duty calls, Nora says. I'm glad you all answered it with me. I didn't think you'd go for it. Akbar suggested we all work together again, and I thought he was crazy.
There's money,
Jazz says with a shrug.
And there's drink,
Sinjir adds. Jom frowns.
Oh, this is going to be fun. Come on, the job awaits.
Nora smiles. Temin stands on the ramp of Jazz's ship. He waves. She waves back and heads aboard,
ready to see where the next adventure takes them.
Interlude, Chandrilla.
What's your name? Your rank?
Aaliyah asks. The man at the head of the prisoner procession seems taken aback.
I'm Corporal Argel. Camerand Argel, ma'am, you are?
But she doesn't answer. Instead, she demands,
What is this?
She gestures to the lineup of prisoners, Imperials still in uniform partly, Stormtroopers in their underclothes, officers in their grays and blacks. Not a big group, just a dozen or so.
I feel like that's obvious. Prisoners, he continues, looking nervously over to Lug, the Trandoshan, standing there with the camera.
We captured a small holdout garrison down on Coruscant. They're going to be stationed here at one of the camps. And Commander Rohr thought it prudent to parade this lot about a bit, given the triumph of the day and all that.
He blinks.
Am I on camera?
You are, she says. And this isn't right. Take these men to where they belong. They're not cattle. They're not a prize.
But we should be proud of winning this war.
Nobody should be proud of war, Corporal. Nobody. This isn't a thing we do because we like winning. Because of what glory it is to subjugate anybody. We do it because we want to be on the right side of things. This...
She fritters her hands in the air, trying and failing somewhat to contain her anger.
This kind of thing is what the Empire would do. March their prisoners around, a display to rile the blood of the faithful. We don't do that. We have to be better than that. Nod if you understand me.
Hesitantly, he nods.
Of course, ma'am.
Good. Good. Go on now. Tell your commander plans changed.
Argel swallows visibly and gives an awkward wave to the camera. Then he snakes back the way he came, bringing the line of prisoners with him. Olia stands there, fuming. Tracine approaches. The camera is still on. She puts a hand on the Pantoran's shoulder. A small gesture, but enough. Olia lets out a captive breath.
That was something, too. You're actually good at this.
Olia smiles stiffly.
We just need to do better. All of us. If we're going to keep this up, we need to do it right.
Are you worried that the New Republic will get it wrong? That these things, the protester, the orphans, the parade of prisoners, are warning signs? Will the New Republic survive?
Olia turns. She lifts her chin. She speaks with authority.
This is democracy,
she says.
It is strange, and it is messy. It's not about getting it right. It's about trying to get it right. Yes, it's a bit chaotic. Certainly we will get some things wrong. The Empire? They cared nothing for democracy. They valued order above everything else. They wanted to be right so badly that anybody who even hinted at getting it wrong or doing it differently was branded the enemy and thrown in a dark prison somewhere. They destroyed other voices so that only their own remained. That is not us. We will not always get it right. We will never have it perfect. But we will listen to the countless voices crying out across the galaxy. We've opened our ears, and we will always listen. That is how democracy survives. That is how it thrives. Look, there.
She points, and now a new procession. Senators, 100 of them, maybe more, from systems all across the galaxy, even a few from the Outer Rim now, marching toward the old Chandrila Senate House. Small crowds of citizens gathering, applauding, whistling. It's just a start, a humble new beginning. But there it is. Olia smiles.
That is democracy. That is the New Republic. And if you'll excuse me, we have a great deal of work to do. May the Force be with you, Tracine.
The newswoman smiles.
Knock 'em dead, Olia.
Epilogue. Ray stands on the bridge of the Ravager. There, staring out the window at the glowing Vulpinus Nebula, is the fleet admiral. His hands behind his back, humming a little. Something classical. Something from the old Republic days. She listens a little. The Sestina of Imperator Vex, maybe?
Sir,
she says.
He holds up his finger,
a sign for patience. He continues humming, his head swaying, until it reaches a small crescendo. Then, without turning toward her, he lowers his finger and says,
"Yes, Admiral Sloan."
"Something I've been wanting to ask you."
"You may always speak frankly with me."
He turns to face her. His countenance is cold, his stare scrutinizing, like she's wet, fresh meat, and he's picking her apart to look for the tastiest bits.
"Please."
"The summit on Akiva."
"Dreadful thing."
"It did not go as planned."
She hesitates.
"Though, now I'm not so sure. Did you plan for it to go that way?"
He smiles.
"Explain."
"I've been thinking. Everything happened so fast. Faster than it should have. Faster than any timeline predicted. And I wondered, did we have someone in our midst who summoned the rebels? I went and I looked, and I found communications. From an encrypted channel on this very ship. Sent out to what appears to be a rebel frequency."
"Enlighten me. Why would I have cause to do that?"
She hesitates.
"I've been thinking about that. I would guess to eliminate competition."
"An interesting theory."
"I'm more interested if it's an accurate one, Admiral."
He takes her hand and gives it a squeeze.
"It was a test."
"I could have died there, on Akiva, or been taken captive."
"But that did not happen. You were not captured, and you remain alive. You are my best and my brightest, and that is why you passed this test. I need people like you." This, a question she hates to ask.
"And if I hadn't survived?"
"Then my assessment of you would have been wrong. You would not have been my best and my brightest. It's like the others, Pandion, Shale, and so forth. They were weak, sick animals that had to be culled from the herd. They did not pass the test, and now they are no burden to us."
She tries to repress a shiver.
"Here,"
he continues, pointing out at the glowing red bands of the Vulpinus Nebula, the swooping whorls of crimson clouds and the stars beyond them.
"Look out there. That is no longer our galaxy."
"Admiral, we have not lost yet."
"Oh, but we have. I see the dismay in your eyes, but this is no cause for despair, Admiral Sloan. This is how it must be. The Empire became this ugly, inelegant machine. Crude and inefficient. We needed to be broken into pieces. We needed to get rid of those who want to see that old machine churning ineluctably forward. It's time for something better. Something new. An empire worthy of the galaxy it will rule."
Sloane doesn't know what to feel right now. It's some strange mix of terror, disgust, but also hope? Did he try to betray her? Or was it truly a test he expected her to pass? All she manages to say right now is,
"Of course, Admiral."
"Now, if you will excuse me, I have thinking to do."
He gently touches her shoulder. A seemingly warm gesture, until he uses it to turn her around and send Sloane on her way.
This is Mark Thompson. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of Star Wars Aftermath, Book 1 of the Aftermath Trilogy, by Chuck Wendig. This program was directed by Kevin Thompson, executive producer Aaron Blank. Star Wars Aftermath is a production of Lucasfilm Limited and registered or trademarked where indicated. Copyright 2015. All rights reserved. Used under authorization. Music composed by John Williams. Music publishing by Warner Tamerlane Publishing Corporation and Bantha Music. Music Master Production Copyright 2007, Lucasfilm Limited. This has been a Penguin Random House audio presentation. All rights reserved.